Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is Maria Brito, author of How Creativity Rules the World, The Art and Business of Turning Your Ideas into Gold. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Maria Brito to talk about her book, How Creativity Rules the World, The Art and Business of Turning Your Ideas into Gold, published by HarperCollins. Originally from Venezuela, Maria Brito was selected by Complex Magazine as one of the 20 power players in the art world, as well as being named one of Art News Magazine's deciders. She has advised hip-hop moguls, Oscar-winning actors, Tony-winning producers, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, and many more. She's written for publications such as Entrepreneur, Huffington Post, Elle, Forbes, ArtNet, Cultured Magazine, and Departures. For several years, Maria has taught her creativity course in companies, and in 2019, she launched Jumpstart, an online program on creativity for entrepreneurs based on years of research and observation in both the areas of business and art. Maria also wrote and hosted The C-Files with Maria Brito, a TV and streaming service for PBS's new station, All Arts, and interesting facts. She is a graduate of Harvard University and Harvard Law School. Maria, congratulations on How Creativity Rules the World, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas. I'm so happy to be here, and hello, everybody who's listening. Thank you for being here with us today.
Oh, it's great to be able to interview you. So you went to Harvard University, like many U.S. presidents, but you were not born in the U.S., which, as you may know, means you cannot become president of the United States.
Thank God.
Yes. Well, however, Maria, stay with me on this. Four of the nine U.S. Supreme Court justices are graduates of Harvard Law School, just like you. So if this art thing doesn't work out for you, you might want to think about getting on the Supreme Court.
Oh, no, 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 no. That's really not for me. I ran away from this whole law thing 13 years ago, and I'm not looking back.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, don't rule it out. If you want to do that, yeah. I might be able to help. You know, when you're the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, you know people, okay? And I'm just going to leave it at that. But so when you were at Harvard Law School, did you know another student there named Elle Woods?
Oh, from Legally Blonde.
Oh, it was a fascinating documentary she made about her time at Harvard Law School. Really,
yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I loved her pink. Her pink outfits were very inspiring.
I loved them too. Is it okay if I say that? I liked them. I loved. Seriously, that was a joke, but I really liked that movie. And it's yet another thing that my daughter introduced me to. So now you touched on this. You are what I would call a recovering lawyer. You wrote that you were once a miserable corporate attorney working at a big law firm in New York City. So first off, congratulations on your escape from the legal profession. What is it that made you have this major career transition and leave that world?
I never wanted to be an attorney. I think that like many people growing up in the 80s. And at that time, I was, as you very well said, I was born and raised in Venezuela, and my parents had a very conservative way of seeing things. And I wanted to be a singer, I wanted to be a performer, or I wanted to be somewhat in the arts. And I was brainwashed into this idea that to have a solid future or somewhat secure, you had to have a dependable career, like being a doctor, or being an attorney, or being an engineer, or whatnot. And so I ended up believing it. And I think that I had a lot of big dreams and dreamt about all those John Grisham movies and attorneys looking amazing and things like that. And it was nothing like that, because I was a corporate attorney and I was tied to a desk for 16 hours. And I have nothing against lawyers. I mean, they're great people, the truth is, but it was not for me. So this was something that I had been pondering for many years, what was my escape. And when I had my first child, I realized that I was going to become a role model and that I needed to do something that really was fulfilling to me, and I did not have to prove anything to my parents or to anybody. And I had always had a very strong connection to visual arts. My parents actually did get me to all the museums and galleries, and we traveled the world with the intention of getting cultivated. But it was a hobby for them. And so I decided that upon years of me informally suggesting artists to friends and family and having those artists gain value over time, that I wanted to get into the world of becoming an art advisor and curator and whatnot without having a previous history in that world. And I quit. I mean, my first child was probably about 8 months or 9 months when I quit that job, and I never looked back again. That was it.
Oh, that's great. I admire you for doing that. And I kind of a similar thing happened to me when I was younger. I was an Army officer, my dad had been an Army officer. His father had been an Army officer. And after about 3 years, I said, wait a minute, I don't want to do this. And they would have, you know, been happy with anything I did. But it was a sort of an epiphany where I woke up and said, oh, you know, what am I doing? And then I had to laugh because when you suddenly went off in this major direction, it reminded me a little bit. And we'll talk about this. You talk about taking risks in the book. And it reminded me of 20 years ago when I left a job to start my own agency. I sent out a little card to all my contacts, and it said, in lieu of a midlife crisis, Douglas Burdett has left a secure job with Barker, Campbell, Farley, and Mansfield to start his own agency. And even Ad Age wrote about it. So it was very funny. So I could definitely empathize with it, and we're going to talk about empathy. Now, out of approximately 375 books featured on the podcast when this publishes, only two others really have been about creativity. So I was very interested to be able to read this and have you on the show. The other two are The Creative Curve by Alan Gannett and Nir Bashan's book, The Creator Mindset. And I'm going to include links to those interviews on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. Now, this one is it's about that topic, but it's still very, very different. We're going to talk about that. I just wanted to read Daniel Pink endorsed the book, and he wrote, Maria Brito has crafted a first-rate guide to creativity that explodes the many myths about the topic and places this elusive ability within anyone's grasp. If you're looking to get unstuck, this is a book for you. So one thing I wanted to mention about the book was it was a bit of an adventure to read. It's a different book, and I want the listeners to understand it's slightly different from, you know, hundreds of the other marketing and sales books. Not to take anything away from them, but as I was reading through the book, you show how various artists throughout time how they approached creativity, and it sent me down several Wikipedia rabbit holes, because it took me a little longer to read the book only because I was enjoying it, and I would then go and want to read even more about these the artists, many of whom I was familiar with and we've all heard about, but I just didn't know some of the backstory on these folks. So that was just to let the listener know that they might have a similar experience when they're reading this. So I'm going to read from the introduction, which is page VII, or as the Romans would say, 7. Today, everything and everyone competes for our attention. We live in a world that constantly drowns all of our senses. It is not enough to do something well. It is necessary to stand out, to be different, to be creative. Mastering this skill will not only benefit your career, but also have a ripple effect in all you do. This book will teach you how to do that for life. Businesses need to get noticed. Marketers want to sell more. Artists long to create impact. Entrepreneurs look for ways to surprise and delight their customers with every new turn. But most people fail at these endeavors because they don't know how to. The good news is that you possess a never-ending and always renewable source you can use to make money, reinvent yourself, pivot your business, or create products or services that your clients will love and will keep them coming back. It's called creativity. No matter what the issue, you can discover ways that disrupt and shake, allow you to make noise and gain influence. Get your practice noticed or your big idea materialized. Every breakthrough in every industry and field comes from people who use their creativity to think differently. Developing your unique ability to express your ideas while generating value to your clients, your audience, or the people you serve will take you far. Whether you are an entrepreneur, an artist, or an employee, your creativity will help you turn the mundane into the extraordinary. This is the most crucial skill to have on your path towards success. Creative people come up with solutions that are relevant and novel for today's world. For years, you've been told that to be like them, you had to come to this world with a special God-given talent, that there's something inside these visionaries that sets them apart and which nobody else can emulate. However, that is not true. Nearly everything that you've been told about creativity is a lie. Don't believe the myth that creativity is only for the few chosen ones or that it is genetic. It's false to think that you either have it or you don't, that it can't be taught or learned. Trust me, you were not born with a deficit in your creative abilities. Whoever said only artists are creative or that only scientists, engineers, and tech people innovate was dead wrong. Creativity is not about arts and crafts and cutouts or technical wizardry. Creativity is about fostering specific habits, making associations, and standing behind the ideas that come out of them. The old adage, think outside the box, doesn't cut it anymore. The most creative people in the world have a bag of tricks that help them nurture and grow their best ideas. This book gives you timeless strategies and tools that have been used time and again by people from all walks of life throughout history. And then moving on, one other short part. In this book, you'll discover how to do all of the following. Turn your business around. Invent something new. Get unstuck. Adopt habits and teach your brain to see things that others miss. Make associations that you never thought about before and materialize your best ideas. So I wanted to mention the value of creativity. You talked about a couple of studies, and then I want to ask you about this. But you write about how IBM conducted a survey of more than 1,500 CEOs from 60 countries and 33 industries worldwide. 60% of those CEOs answered that successfully navigating our complex world requires creativity over other qualities such as rigor, management, discipline, or integrity. Creativity is the number one quality they look for when they're hiring people and also when deciding whom to keep employed. And then you go on, you talk about LinkedIn. They've been scanning the information shared in the network by roughly 660 million professionals searching for the skills that were most in demand in relation to its supply. The number one in demand skill turns out to be creativity. And then you also mentioned Adobe. They interviewed 5,000 adults in the US, UK, Germany, France, and Japan that showed that only 1 in 4 people believed they were living up to their creative potential, and 4 in 10 said that they didn't have the tools or access to the tools they needed to become creativity. So you write that companies and organizations are aware of the importance of creativity, as I just mentioned, in the workplace and beyond, but they struggle with the unorthodox idea that creativity can be taught and learned. What Is it because they haven't read your book, or what is this perception they have of what it is that you can help them with?
I think that the word creativity itself has been enveloped in a lot of erroneous conclusions and myths that are not accurate. And one of the very and most important things I'd like people to think about is that creativity is not just one thing. It is an amalgamation of skills that you very well talked about before, and it's about risk-taking, it's about authenticity, empathy, curiosity. It's about trusting our own thoughts and intuition at any given time to come forward with our best ideas. And so when the word creativity has pretty much lost the actual meaning, which is coming up with ideas of value that are relevant, because we have to make those ideas be appropriate for whatever it is, the world that we're living. And so I think that there is this gap between what these company managers and CEOs are looking for and what the people who want those jobs, or even entrepreneurs who are right out there in the world trying to get their products sold and things like that, there is this gap that exists that has been unfairly perpetuated for too long. And this book comes to bridge that gap, because the truth is that the skills and the habits are something that everyone can work on, because we already have that inside of us. And the tools and techniques that I mentioned in part three of the book are how to materialize those ideas, because I also wanted to give people the entire package. I wanted to be very thorough about what you can do once you have the ideas. And so the problem that also we have faced for too long is that the word, again, creativity has been attributed just to people in the arts or people in creative fields. And everybody can be creative, and everybody's actually very creative since birth, but we don't claim it enough and we don't use it enough because, you know, education, formalities of how the educational system in this country and every other country actually works, and the media, the amount of information that we get, so that gets a lot of conditioning in the ways that we think, and instead of teaching us how to think. And so I set out to do this because I wanted to make sure that we close that gap. We're in a very crucial stage in humanity where this continues to be the most crucial skill that anybody can actually possess to thrive in anything you do. And it can help you in decision making and day-to-day activities. It's the creativity shouldn't only be for people who want to come up with the next cure to cancer. Although if you're doing that, that's amazing. But what I'm trying to do with this book is to put it at everybody's grasp and reach. Like Dan Pink was so generous with his quote. And he sent me a very nice email saying that he was very interested in the whole concept because, you know, he's thorough too, and he felt that this is going to be a guide that people will keep coming back to read again because it's very timeless in the concepts.
Yes, and when you mentioned relevance in creativity, it's very important because I think a lot of people mistake what may seem like a creative person or a creative pursuit is not really as relevant. Now, you started to touch on the educational system, and in the book, I don't know which page, but you wrote about some studies assessed and monitored the creative abilities of children, and then it's almost as if it was removed. Over time, people's creative abilities decline. And I later, you know, we might even want to talk about how to try to get back to that child's mind. But what is it that happens that starts to wring out the creativity starting in our childhood?
You know, that study is crucial, and it actually starts on page 26. And it is Dr. George Land, who's he passed away already, but him and his wife were hired by NASA to evaluate the astronauts and the engineers, because NASA wanted to put the most creative people. It was not about the most intelligent or the most reliable. It was the most creative people in the most challenging assignments. So they were hired by NASA to develop this evaluation, and it worked out really well. And they said, why don't we try it on kids to see what happens to people as they grow? And so they had this Head Start program where they tested all these kids, and when they were really young, and you know, I think that they were 5 years old when they were first tested, 98% of them actually scored at the highest level of creativity. And so the very same kids were retested again at age 10 and at age 15. And the results were absolutely different. Only 30% of the 10-year-olds scored as, you know, creative, and only 12% of the 15-year-olds scored at the highest level of creativity. And once they made this very same test available to 280,000 adults, averaging 30 years old, more or less, only just 2% of those people scored as highly creative. And so what is the conclusion for this study is that education, the way the rigidity of the educational systems is actually pushing our creativity far away from us. And it's also proving that we are all creative. Other people involved in testing kids call it the fourth grade slump, and because this is when children have already absorbed so much education by the time they are in fourth grade, and this is when they start just thinking like robots. And one thing that we have also been used to is all the standardized tests and things like that. And so studying for that, because that's the way people are measured to go to college, and this is the way that people are measured when I graduated law school, I had to take the bar exam and things like that, is that people are tested on this like right or wrong, black or white. And that is actually not how people become creative. And if you think about it, tons of the most successful entrepreneurs in history in this country are dropouts from college, right? And I'm not saying college.
Some
is
from
bad.
Harvard, like Zuckerberg, yeah. And Gates.
Absolutely, and Steve Jobs also, you know, dropped out of Reed. And mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to say is that it's not that college is bad. What I'm saying is that there is one reason that is very clear of why we have lost this ability on the way. And that's why those studies from IBM and Adobe and LinkedIn are telling us that once, you know, you are in the midst of this, you know, storm that we've been through, what the people want is people who can come up with solutions to problems, and also who can figure out new ways to tackle new markets or to reinvent a business. And this is, you know, is the daily bread of marketers, right? I mean, you need to know how to make noise with your campaigns, and or how to reach different people, or how to make your product stand out in this massive sea of consumption, right? Because there are 5 million things competing with your product at the same time, and it's not even in the same category, right? I mean, it's like everything is clumped together in a huge sea of distraction. And so why is that we want to be creative? Is that because we want to make sure that we stand out too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise we're invisible. And I like to remind businesses that they're not competing with their direct competitors. They're competing with cat videos as it relates to the attention of their prospective customers. So before we get into the myths of creativity, and I touched on some of them in the introduction, I want to quote from this and talk about Maria Brito some more and talk about crisis. You write, after 44 years, the first half in Venezuela, I survived two failed coup d'etat, tear gas day in and day out, and lootings and shootings. Okay, that was Venezuela. In the second half, living in New York City, I lived through 9/11, the financial crisis of 2008, Hurricane Sandy, fights between political extremists, Black Lives Matter protests, and other vicissitudes. But I never imagined that in the era of technology, we would face such an unprecedented opponent. In the blink of an eye, we went from the optimism of welcoming a new decade to protagonists in a sci-fi movie. And I think a lot of people are probably feeling that way. So, you know, one could argue that we are living through a period of crisis. So explain how that's actually a potential gold mine of creativity. And in other words, how does calamity actually fuel creativity?
Well, listen, there has also been a myth, which is you have to suffer to be creative. And that's usually something that pertains to people in the arts or people in music and whatever, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I'm not in any way, shape, or manner advocating for suffering, you know, in any way. I don't want people to suffer about how they are going to come up with their ideas. But the great thing about living in a crisis is that you have less resources that you would normally have, right? And either because it's less money or you're in a time crunch, the world that you knew is no longer, so definitely less resources. And there have been also studies that I quote very briefly that when people go through complicated and harsh times, they face adversity, and there is something that happens in their brains and emotions that is called post-traumatic growth, and it's conducive, right, for people to become resourceful, because lack of resources, it immediately pushes you to figure out how to come up with a solution for the problem that you're facing. And that's why businesses did not full stop. They had Zoom and Google Hangout and ways of doing things so that we could continue moving the economy forward. And usually if you are someone who's trying to get funding from, let's say, a venture capitalist or any sort of external capital, right, they are not going to give you a blank check with like, here is your $50 million seed capital to start tomorrow, right? I mean, you have very limited resources, and if you're good at managing them, you're going to make something happen with that. And so that's why also crisis and constraints and deadlines and all the type of things that are actually reducing what you always have available are excellent triggers and mind goals for creativity. And if you go and look at history, when the Black Death ravaged the whole of Italy and Europe in the 1400s, right after that, the Italian Renaissance is just one of the most important really movements in history for architecture, literature, art, inventions, science, etc. Happened right after the Black Death, because the people in Florence were like, we're not going to be left behind. Just, you know, we are going to figure out how to come up stronger out of this. And then after the Spanish flu, after the Second World War, we had Cubism, Surrealism, Art Deco. And, you know, it was like an incredible time where the most amazing ideas flourished, because there was so much part of it was pent-up demand, but also people had gone through like unspeakable and terrible, you know, moments, and witnessing the horrors of the war along with like a massive pandemic. And closer in history, after 2008, when the entire collapse of the financial system in the United States also gave birth to the social media revolution, the content creators, that also was part of an escape and a time where a lot of different circumstances came together to provide different outlets for people. And so I'm very excited about the next few years, because we are going to see a renaissance in many different industries, and we're going to see industries that we didn't know about, and we're going to have people coming up with more and more ideas. And that is actually very encouraging. I know we're still in the thick of things.
Yes.
But this time is going to open up an enormous windows of opportunity for the people who are able to grab them.
Yes, and just like you're talking about that time right after World War I, during that pandemic and that recovery, 100 years from now, they'll certainly be talking about this period we're going through right now and what's to come. So it was a beautiful way of explaining that in chaos lies opportunity, and boy, is there opportunity right now. So
yes.
Keep that in mind. Now, if we don't talk about anything else, you've got to indulge me. We have to destroy definitively some of these myths.
Yes.
That have kept creativity, you know, elusive and sacrosanct. And I have to laugh because at one point I worked at an agency, at agencies in New York, and there was a creative department. And woe be unto an account executive that would come up with a creative idea. So it was sort of funny. But that's actually the same place where you talk about Dr. Land on page 26. Can you talk about some of these myths that probably drive you crazy?
They do, because when I have taught this, my program in companies and online, people come and tell me, well, that's something that you either have or you don't. And, mm-hmm. and that's not true. We, as I said before, we are all born highly creative, and depending on the circumstances and the type of schools that we go and how we move through life, we bury that enormous, you know, power that we have within us, because we don't understand that we have everything to actually get come up with ideas and execute them and materialize them, right? But for example, a lot of people think that creative people are just like sitting down and waiting for inspiration to strike. And, you know, like there's, and that's not true. Creativity flourishes the more we work. And, you know, that's like, one of the things that, oh my God, I just have to be sitting down on a square, you know.
Yeah, with a bottle of scotch. Right. Yeah. It, you know, I had to chuckle to myself when you would talk about these author or these artists throughout the ages. The work ethic they had was just amazing.
It was. It was. And actually, you know, there isn't a part where I mentioned that Picasso was working every day, including weekends, and he would get into his studio and lock the room and lock the door and not let anybody in. And he probably would start working like around noon or 11 a.m. and by 3 in the morning. And it's not a coincidence that he is the most prolific artist in history. And also, when Picasso died, he actually, Picasso was not rich, because like that's the other thing. Like, oh, but guess he what? No. He was not rich at all. He was the son of a school teacher and his mom was a housewife, and they had to move from a city to the next because they were making no money. And it was also the time, you know, of great also economic depression in Europe. And when Picasso died, he had his net worth was $500 million in 1973. That's $2.9 billion today. Picasso did not even have an assistant. Imagine the nimble operation of this guy, and that he just worked all his life. And again, like, the Guinness World Records, they have certified him as the most prolific artist in history. And a lot of it has to do with his work ethics. When people asked him, where do you come with ideas? You know what he said? I get to work. I take my pen and I start writing, or I start scribbling. And this is where the ideas start to well. And I mean, it's an incredible example, not only as an artist, but as an entrepreneur, because that's what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other ones is the idea that the creativity is just for artists. I mean, no, folks, it's for everybody. You can be an accountant and you can be creative. And I mentioned a few examples in the book, like Thomas Alva Edison was not an artist, and he's one of the most creative minds in history. And I also make an interesting note about the invention of actually how champagne, the region, and the drink changed in France due to the work of Father Perignon, who, you know, he was a monk, literally.
You know, very hardworking one, very devoted.
Yeah, but they ask him, you have to help us figure out how to reveal this abbey that was burned to the ground. And the man figured out most of the new techniques that are used by the big champagne houses. He invented them.
Right, because he needed revenues for the,
absolutely,
the abbey.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, if a monk who lives on prayer can actually be creative, yes, please do not tell me you cannot be, you know?
Yes, yes. And then there are so many other engineers and people that just had all these creative approaches. You mentioned a few minutes ago the word authenticity, and that is really, I don't want to say a buzzword, but it's really important in marketing now more than ever, I would think. Mm-hmm. And inauthenticity is probably even more deadly. And you write on page 71 that companies that want to boost creativity and innovation should focus on cultivating more authenticity in their team's emotional climates. Can you talk about the importance of authenticity as it relates to creativity?
You know, I think that each one of us, and we are many, 7 billion of us on this planet, have a very unique set of circumstances, experiences, education, the things that happen to us that shape who we are. And because of that, we do things, and we do see things, and we do things that are not like your neighbor. And even siblings can grow up with the same mom and dad, and they have a completely different way of seeing the world. And so people have become afraid of expressing their ideas because of the fear of coming up short or because of the fear that they are going to be criticized and whatnot. And so one of the examples in the book is that, the people who believe that they cannot speak up or whatever, there was a study that was conducted by researchers from Wharton Business School and the London School of Economics. And they, these guys were called, the researchers and professors were called by a couple or many more tech companies to analyze why they were not beating their competitors. And they noticed the reason why is because there was no authentic expression of emotions in the company's teams. They were keeping the ideas for themselves out of fear of what the managers, superior CEOs would think. And the other companies that they went to where people could express freely what they thought, even if it was negative, because that's the point, right? Mm-hmm. Those were actually cutting ahead and getting ahead of the game. And so the authenticity doesn't mean you're going to be crying through the holes of your company or, it's not about that. I mean, it's more about how can I say what I think and feel safe? And if people are listening and they are C-suite or they run departments, it's important to allow people to have a safe space to communicate ideas without feeling rejected, criticized, made fun of, or whatever it is, right? I mean, I'm sure that people don't want to do that in purpose, but it happens a lot because yes. we wouldn't have this data, and we wouldn't have professors from Wharton going into these companies and writing studies that are peer reviewed because they understand that there is an issue here too with expression and with authenticity of what people think at any given time. And it happens the same thing with entrepreneurship. People want to create things, but then they copy the person next. The guy next door, how is that going to be successful if you're just literally copying verbatim? And so that's not authentic. I'm not saying you can come up with things that are 100% original because that's not possible. I also mentioned that in the book. The bar is too high if you think that being creative is just going to come up with something that nobody has ever seen. Creativity is about improving, changing, combining, coming up with different angles of what it already exists. But if you're just copying exactly what your neighbor is doing, that's not creative at all. And it's just not a very interesting thing for anybody to invest on. And that's why I encourage people, and that's one of the very first habits that I encourage people in the book to cultivate, is to dig into who you really are and put your story in your products and business if it's relevant.
Yes, yes. And two things. One, it brings to mind a study I remember hearing about that Google did about the idea of psychological safety.
Yes.
Where they determined that that was one of the most important things for their growth and success. Also, there was a book on the show a couple of years ago called Traction about marketing, and particularly marketing for startups. And in the book, they talk about how the tech world could possibly be the worst at doing exactly what the other companies do in terms of marketing. And in that book, they said, look, there's about 19 things you should probably try and test and then stay with the three or four that work, double down on those. They show example after example of companies that actually did sort of dig into that and explore what actually worked best for them and their customers worked very, very well. Let's move on to what I think is the most important word in marketing and sales, if not life is empathy. And on page 79, you write, some of the most creative and successful businesses in the world were built on empathy. From the animation of his films to the design of his theme parks, Disney's number one concern was always how people would feel when experiencing his creations. And earlier, you write, empathy is the key to thinking differently, a cornerstone of creativity and entrepreneurship and elsewhere. So can you talk about the importance of empathy, and if you have any idea why it's so difficult for companies to do?
You know, the topic of empathy and creativity in business has been on the top shelf recently because of the pandemic and obviously how the boss treats the employees and how is an idea of what people may be feeling, and also your customers, right? What is it to be on their shoes? Because when we talk about authenticity, is bringing your inside out, but being empathetic is taking the outside in. And so how can you actually serve people and make them happy and be a successful business if you do not understand the feelings of what the customers want, or you don't understand the feelings of what your audience wants, right? And so it's a difficult thing because we tend to live too much in our own heads, and for better or worse, all the separation, the technological space, and it's not just because of the pandemic. Let's talk about how much people spend time online, and that our young generations just live with those things. Our kids are playing video games all day long, right? And so that has made people lost a lot of the human touch, people's skills, the ability to talk to each other, seeing people in their own eyes. So if you are on an echo chamber all day long and you're alone, and then you have a disadvantage with respect to empathy, because there's no other way you can learn about other people's feelings and desires and emotions if you don't observe them and if you are not exchanging opinions and moments with them. So it is very important for managers, for CEOs, and for entrepreneurs and anything that you do to be attuned to the feelings of others. And if the others are there and you are paying attention and you're listening, and you know, you are going to get an enormous response back from that. It's just as simple as observing people and mingling with people and seeing what they're doing and asking them questions, to your people, your customers, your clients, your employees, can only bring an enormous amount of information that will actually help you succeed.
Yes, and I just loved it when you talked about how Disney's number one concern was always how people would feel. And I think that empathy may be confused by a lot of people as being sympathy or compassion or pity, but this is about putting yourself in the other person's shoes. And I would like to remind folks, you don't have to do it perfectly. Just do it a little bit better than your competition. And it really works enormously well. And it also brings to mind one of my favorite quotes from Maya Angelou about people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel. So one of the great questions that could help a lot of companies is, how are we making our customers feel? So Maria, let's go on to a topic that a lot of people wish that I would learn more about, and that's being quiet.
Yes.
It's just not going to happen. I can even in first grade, they said, you know, you talk too much, you ask too many questions, stop it. See, they were wringing the creativity out of me at an early age, but I'd like to think that I fought back. So I wanted a quote from you. You talk about co-working spaces, trading floors, friendly open floor plan offices, along with their incessant addiction to electronics, social media, and news, are slowly but surely strangling our best ideas. What role does silence and solitude play in creativity? And I should add, I was surprised. You talked about, I guess, how many hundreds or thousands of studios you've been in. They're largely quiet places.
They are. You know, the importance of silence is that it is both a moment of incubation. And you know, incubation effect is the part of creativity where you have been hard at work trying to figure out what to do next, what is your next move, if you want to shift careers, if you want to change a job, if you want to launch a new product, what is the campaign going to look like? So you're hard at work, and then you need to move on, and you need to be silent about everything, and you need to give your brain a break. And this is something that people take lightly, and it's not even optional, because this is, again, a prerequisite for intuition and for ideas pouring in. And the importance of silence and solitude throughout history, obviously, I refer back to artists, but I also talk about how Steve Jobs was such a proponent of Zen meditation. And those names sound so exaggerated sometimes that scare people, right? Like, you don't have to be in a room with candles and, you know, special music in a grotto with infrared lights in lotus position. No, it's, you know, closing your eyes for 5 minutes a day and taking a deep breath can do wonders for you if you really do it. And I encourage people to, if you are not in the meditation, you know, woo-woo thing, just close your eyes, dedicate time to think, and increase a minute a week if needed be. And the importance of all this is that, again, when you quiet and you slow down your rhythm and you allow for ideas to come instead of you being producing them all the time, mm-hmm. forcing them, you enter in this space of like, let me allow for things to come to me rather than me being chasing them and forcing them and having the universe on a chokehold, right? And which is kind of a very common thing of managers, is like the go, go, do. And why am I not coming up with ideas? Have you ever taken a vacation? Have you ever been on, you know, a weekend where you turn everything off, right? And so mm-hmm. the best ideas and the most important discoveries always come to people who spend these, the aha moments happen so much when people are taking a shower, because they are, it's the truth, it's because you can't have a phone and, you know, a TV and 7 monitors and 200 people in your bathroom. If you do, I mean, amazing. I don't know who does that.
Some people are into that sort of thing, Maria. Most of us aren't. Yeah.
What I'm saying is, it's not a coincidence. It's when you are in a shower, nothing else is happening, and you give your brain a moment,
yes,
to like settle on its own. And do that on purpose. Do that on purpose. Spend 5 minutes in silence. Put a timer. Close your eyes. Allow for the answers to come. And again, the topic also of intuition and creativity in business is not explored enough, because it cannot be measured. It's not empirical. But it turns out that the most creative people in the world, and also the best business people in the world, do trust their guts. Mm-hmm. And without having moments of silence, believe me, your intuition is going to only bring you noise, and it's never going to be right. You just have to allow yourself to have pockets of silence throughout your day, if possible, and you will see so many great ideas and answers come to you.
So, Maria, let's go from silence to another one of my favorite topics. That's about daydreaming. And so the listener knows you just talked about intuition. There's big sections of the book about intuition and how to prompt your intuition. But I want to talk about daydreaming. You write, take daydreaming seriously, even if in the beginning all you get out of it are a bunch of bizarre ideas. Don't let your conscious mind take you away from what could be a revolutionary innovation. In the end, the unconscious mind rules most of our human functions. Daydreaming helps tap our subconscious, is the engine of information processing in our brains, and it is filled with valuable fantasies, memories, and dreams. So I know this is a really crazy question, but how can we leverage our daydreaming? Are there certain do's and don'ts, or it's okay to daydream, basically. It was my takeaway.
Well, you know, a lot of people are grounded in reality, of course, and we all have to be, but to extend that they kill the ideas before the ideas actually take a hold of reality. In other words, I think that if you would have asked any big entrepreneur and like, let's say, do you really think that 30 years ago when, you know, Elon Musk was thinking and he was reading science fiction, did he take himself away to going to Mars, or was he actually fueling his subconscious with those ideas? Because one of the things that he has said many times is that he spent many years of his childhood reading science fiction novels and trips around the world and the universe, and he started pondering questions. It's like, why people cannot live in other planets? So is that something that is so crazy right now? I guess not, because we already are working on those trips, interstellar and outside of this world. And the daydreaming part of an entrepreneur and a creative person is to really allow the impossible to come in. And same thing with Steve Jobs. Would you have thought even 20 years ago that in your phone you will have your entire office and that you will press a button and you would see someone on the other side of the world on a screen on the same time? And it's not a story of, you know, Disney's Epcot Center, is reality. So why are we daydreaming more? It's because we are also pushed down in our creativity and our creative faculties. And when you go to school, they tell you this is what's possible. It's empirically proved. Science says, or, you know, can you measure it? Is it math? Is it physics? Is it chemistry? If it's not within those parameters, then we don't really want to get into that, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, the most outlandish ideas could potentially become something. It's your desire to actually entertain them. And if it's, I always tell my students too, and my clients, if it's against the laws of nature, please do not attempt. Or if it's illegal. But if it's not, why not? Why cannot we actually allow ourselves a time to indulge in our favorite fantasies surrounding our businesses, our practices? What if? Start with a what if. And I like to encourage people to, like, you know, cut words and like, you know, little images from the internet and kind of create your own collage with crazy thoughts. And it's not a mood board and it's not a vision board. It's more like, what if this would exist? What if we would have a flying car? What if we could actually find instead of people going to plastic surgeons, they take a pill and they lose 10 years of their life. I mean, not that you lose it, but, you know, you look 10 years younger.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to have some memories wiped out. No, I'm kidding.
Well, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that the realm of imagination, it's something that we as adults do not take seriously. And it is also, it's a place where we have to try to go often, because if we allow imagination, emotions, and empathy all together to drive these ideas and we are able to execute them, we have gotten to a place where 95% of humans do not allow themselves to go, adults.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you already have a leg up if you think about this, right? And I encourage people really to not let your imagination go, because imagination as intuition is almost like a sixth sense, right? We don't even have, things come to our minds and we don't even know where they came from. And it's important to pay attention and be serious about those ideas, because you never know what's in them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's, you know, here's a tip that came to mind, which was just go for walks. Turn your phone off if you have to bring it with you, and don't allow any other distractions. Just go for a while and think, because it brings to mind the idea of being in the shower, where you really don't have anything else to distract from what you're thinking about. I wanted to talk a bit about risk taking and failure, and it seems to me like failure may be one of the biggest impediment, or fear of failure impediment, yep, to creativity. And on page 139, you write, doing something new and creating something of value requires experimentation. If you want to do something unique, you must be at peace with the idea that you don't know the outcome and you may fail. Yeah. Horrifying. There is no wisdom and no success without a letdown. Handling failure well is something that good artists and entrepreneurs know how to do. To succeed in new and creative fields, you must become comfortable with being uncomfortable. What advice do you have for folks about how to become more comfortable with getting out of their comfort zone and potentially failing at something?
Well, this is all that goes so intertwined with when we talked about authenticity, right? I mean, in emotions and how all these other researchers are measuring the success or failure of these tech companies if people are allowed to speak the truth. And so, and you very well mentioned also the Google, the policy of emotional safety. And I think that without risk, there's no gains, right? I mean, when I quit my job as a corporate attorney, it was 9 years. I had a very, very good salary. I had a 401k. A car drove me home every night because after 9 p.m. or 8 p.m., I don't know. I don't even want to remember. So, I mean, my life was really good. And I quit that job and I said, the hell with this. It's not me. It's not authentic. And I want to do what makes me happy. And you know what? It was, again, it was the greatest risk I've taken in my life, and I did it without looking back because I was passionate about what I was going to do. And I didn't even, I mean, I knew I was going to face many challenges and obstacles, but I was like, this gotta work, right? And when you have a long-term vision and you are in for the long term into something, you have to really make peace with the idea that you are going to fail a few times, whether you are in a company trying to move up the ranks, or you have your own business, or you have a desire to create something from scratch. You have to make sure that you understand that you're not going to have an upward curve, which is sometimes I feel that some millennial folks feel that that's always going to be good, right? Like there is an immediate gratification type of thing, and there is always an easy path to things, and everything is an overnight success. And if it doesn't work out the first time, then I'm going to discard this idea. And so part of also being creative is having grit and having mm-hmm. persistence and having a determination that, okay, look, it didn't work this way. It doesn't mean it's over. We can do other ways. And that's also part of like having, not everybody's cut to be an entrepreneur. If you're in sales, if you're in marketing, you are also an intrapreneur within an organization that can become a leader and influence how other people move and do things by bringing these ideas and this new way of creating an environment where people feel safe if they fail. And you also can make that a point of, you know, of integrated part of your manifesto, is that without ideas, we are not moving forward. Without creativity, we literally stop innovation and progress immediately. And the more fear we invest in like the others or ourselves, we invest our time and our effort in thinking, I am such afraid of failure, that you're never going to have a creative idea, because being creative is coming up with the new, and the new sometimes is untested, and the new is uncertain. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, take calculated risks. If you are super risk averse, well, measure them, right? I mean, we cannot measure everything, but you know, like if there is some structure and you can go for them, and going back to the example of Google, you know, I think that is 20% of the projects that people are assigned every year can be whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. And no matter what it is, because Google is in 20%, if you think about it, 20% is a really good amount of experimentation. While the 80% is you work on what you know you have to work, the other 20% of your time invested in anything that's outlandish and crazy, because we want to see where do we go with that project. And because we want to make sure that we have the talent in the company working towards something that is interesting, unique, that is relevant for the time that we can use. And, you know, Google has also failed a bunch of projects that they have had to discard and wasted money. And you think about it, well, if, you know, they can waste $1 billion, it's not going to hurt. But if like there is an amount of money that you're willing to put as a gamble aside to test something new, to try something new, that prototype that you've been thinking about, or that, you know, roll out that social media campaign that you don't know what the answer is going to be, just go ahead and do it, because this is something that multiplies and grows as you give yourself the confidence to take a chance and to fail and to just go back, you know, to where you were.
Yes, one of my favorite hacks in business or with clients or anywhere is to say, I want to do a test.
Yeah.
It seems to, oh, you want to do a test. I'm like, we've got a call with a client this afternoon, actually, and we've got some ideas that we want to discuss and explore. But and the client's completely on board. We talk about this all as a test. Let's test something. And then when it's a test, you don't feel like it's such a failure and you might actually succeed. So I want to go on just to, before we wrap up, a couple of the tools of the trade, which is a whole section of the book. And you write that artists and entrepreneurs think differently and throughout history have used diverse techniques, media, and ideas to come up with novel ways of making art, creating products, and getting their creativity flowing. What are some of your favorite ones? And this is a big section of the book, so I know it's an unfair question.
Listen, I'm a kind of person who I come a lot from this mentality that more is more, right? And I like to aggregate things because it's a way for me to use association, which is a very important part of creativity, and sort of like see a big picture of what can happen if we add this, we add this, we put this together, and then how would that look, right? And sometimes that can be overwhelming. It depends on what stage of your business or career you are to be able to aggregate things. And because, I think that aggregation is almost like an experience. If you go to a theme park, let's say Disney for the sake, because we've mentioned Disney. If you go to one of those places, it's filled with things, right? There are supermarkets and restaurants and like dolls and things and toys and rides, and it's an aggregation of many, many things. Mm-hmm. And same thing if you go to a concept store and whatnot, right? And so artists, actually I gave this example of this Japanese collective called the Gutai Group, and they were the ones who actually invented the experience and the experiential, which is the precursor of, the Museum of Ice Cream and all the things that people go and spend, an hour lining up to take a selfie inside, and that have actually generating millions and millions of dollars, all this, like the experience, right, which is kind of like the currency of the past, 5 years. And so artists were already there 50, 60 years ago, creating environments where people would play with light and music and sound and immersive installation and video. And I give that piece of history because I think people don't know this started in the 50s with artists. And so there was an aggregation of features that is something that people like. People like to experience this kind of like immersive installations and things like that. It's same thing with Facebook. Facebook is an aggregation of things, mm-hmm. where people, it was like, it was just a feed with pictures. And then people say, okay, pictures and likes. And then there was likes and Messenger. And then there was business pages. And then there were ads. And so it's an aggregation of features, which is totally the opposite of what Twitter does, which is deconstructing the idea to the minimum, right? So mm-hmm. I totally like the purpose of the section of the tools of the trade is to give people ideas on how to materialize what they have already come up with. Because I feel that a lot of creativity books in my opinion, they are not giving us everything. They are not giving us the whole blueprint, right? And hopefully this is a starting point for people. And this is how they start thinking about their ideas and what's in front of them differently. And so the whole kind of tools of the trade is about how do I materialize, how I put in practice what I already learned in the first and second parts of the book. And so tension is also very important. And creative tension is when you mix opposites. And, mm-hmm. and that's amazing too, right? I mean, the old and the new. People love to see something that is nostalgic to them, but they love to see it reinvented. Those things are incredibly successful in marketing. When even Coca-Cola recently did a whole campaign where they brought the old Santa Claus back and this and that. And people love those things. They go and they buy more of the product. They like more more of the advertisers, because they really feel that they are looking something that their hearts resonate with. And so if there is anything that you can reinvent that is 100 years old, 200 years old, and you can bring it to the present with your own twist, people love that. It's you know, the whole kind of like the bitter and the sweet, you know, the yin and the yang, the profit and the charity, like, you know, like Warby Parker does, things like that. I think people, you know, the response to contrast and opposites is usually very, very positive because it's surprising and the brain loves a surprise for the right reasons.
Yes. So there were entire chapters on deconstructing something, like you talked about with Twitter, aggregating, repeating. The more you do it, the more original it gets, which is talks quite a bit about Monet, where I had no idea the repetition. In other words, the more you repeat something, actually you get better and more authentic. Cross-pollination. And honestly, don't tell the other chapters I said this, but chapter 20, the analog method, blew my mind. It's actually going to create change in my life. And I just wanted to talk about that. And you talk about the analog method. If you could talk about the importance of actually writing with your hand, not necessarily typing. There was, this is what got me, is that there was so much science behind this, about the power of actually writing your ideas down. And I should also add that I think you wrote that Picasso, just before he died in the 1960s, they found that he had like 175 of these journals, and it made the whole art world reassess exactly his whole approach. It didn't seem so creative and scattered. It was very, very well considered and planned. And then was it Da Vinci who had there were like 7,200 pages of notes. He was such a note taker. He wrote everything down, ideas, jokes, all that sort of thing. And that was only like 25% of what he had. And I think people would say, well, they didn't have, you know, the electronic means. But I think folks are missing the point there. Talk about the importance of actually handwriting.
What you say is very accurate about, you know, the two examples that you mentioned, but also Steve Jobs, Gates, where, you know, they are note takers as well. And the studies that, you know, that I've always loved to have a notebook with me, because I feel that when I write things down, my ideas flow. I'm in the moment. If you think about it, the point of taking a piece of paper and a real pen is that you cannot do anything else either also. But there are studies that I quote, and one is the one of the University of Washington that demonstrates that the kids that they were analyzing, and that was second, fourth, and sixth grade, they had a better way to demonstrate their ideas if they were writing by hand versus using a computer, because the interaction of the hand movements and the tactile experience of holding a pen brings information that's being expressed close to the forefront, and it makes the brain pay more attention. This is what a lot of people, if they have heard of the reticular activation system, which is in the frontal part of the brain, it gets activated more when we are paying attention and we are utilizing the movements of our hands. But also, more importantly, there was another one from Princeton and UCLA that was monitoring undergraduate students divided into groups. And the ones who took notes with laptops, they fared way lower than the ones who were actually taking notes with pen and paper, because the brain processing of those who were actually writing notes on a laptop was way shallower. The other ones, because, you know, if you're a fast typer, it's almost an automatic thing. And the ones who were actually taking notes with pen and paper had to synthesize the information. They had to think about it. Mm-hmm. They had to also come up with best notes, because writing obviously is a whole lot slower than typing. And they were having a very deep processing of information. And so there is a whole story of, you know, how people sometimes, you know, they practice this activities in the morning when they wake up, and they do morning pages, and they just like write freehand, and they write, you know, stream of consciousness. And so they just, it's like everything that you want to put there so that you can start your day in a different way. That's one way that I encourage people. I actually use that example, or a prompt in the daydreaming one, because the surrealists used to do that. They used to like just stream of consciousness and just write like crazy. So it's a method that actually was used for the first, or that we know it was used for the first time in the 1920s and 30s by the surrealists. But in the today day, we can all do the same, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write about that UCLA Princeton study, using laptops to take notes impairs learning. pretty clear. I'm just going to quote another on the same page. If you'd like to enhance your creative powers in the early stages or planning a creative project, it is an excellent idea to let ideas flow through the process of longhand writing. And longhand writing multiplies creative thoughts and unravels ideas in ways that other methods can't. And even at the – and I should add, just so to give justice here, at the end of every chapter – I'm talking to the listener now. I don't mean to be talking like you're not here, Maria. But at the end of every chapter, there are very specific things you call the alchemy lab. You see, connected to the word gold in the subhead of the subtitle of the book, but yeah, very specific things, exercises that you can go do. And then even on this one, on page 192, you've got some prompts to get you going in terms of writing. And it's like your to-do list or concerns or what your goals are for that day. It was just, I really appreciated that. And I thought, gosh darn it, I had a feeling, and I've always heard about the benefits of journaling. And I've been journaling through an app on my computer. Going to stop doing that. I'm going to start go back to the little journals that I have. So, Maria, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I want people to actually claim this elusive, that is not so elusive, ability to come up with ideas of value. I want people to claim it for themselves. And the first thing is to acknowledge that they are already creative and that they have everything that they need to succeed. And the tools are not expensive or hard to get, and they just require practice and attention. And so that is my hope for this book. That is a book where people actually can keep coming back, reading and taking separate chapters as they need. Obviously, there is an entire methodology that connects all the parts and all the chapters and builds up. But the takeaway is really to have this incredible confidence that you can come up with ideas, that you can actually do things that are important, relevant, and that can bring you money. That's the other thing. Why do we want to be creative? It's not just because the sake of creativity, is because the more you can come to the,
yes,
the yeah, it's like the
it's
more
where the money is.
Yeah, it's where the money is. And do not let people take that away from you. Do not let anybody tell you you're not creative. Do not let just the people who are sending rockets to Mars. And there's nothing, I mean, I love those guys. What I'm saying is, like, do not let people monopolize these concepts. Do not let people telling you you're not creative. We all are. We really are. And so dig into that and claim it for yourself.
Yes, anyone who reads this book is going to have a lot of head trash removed, but they're also going to be very inspired. And I just had to laugh when you said that, because it's like a lot of companies will think, oh, we can only market our business by hiring an outside firm. It drives me nuts. Like, no, you don't even have to do that. There's so much that you can do. There's no monopoly on that, and certainly not on creativity. So what is just one thing a listener could do today before they do anything else to put in action one of the many ideas from your book that we've talked about?
Two things. I think really important, spend time in silence. We already said that. But I think that people underestimate the importance of this. Please sit down, put a timer, close your eyes. 5 minutes is all I'm asking. And try to do it at least 3 days in a row, and have a notebook with you at all times. That's the second thing I want people to do. Have a notebook with you at all times and write down your ideas and thoughts. And if you can do that in the morning where you're just fresh and light, and do not censor yourself, just go ahead and write freehand. Let your conscious and your subconscious actually come to that pen and put those things into paper and, you know, make sure that not right now, but in the future, you can start reviewing those notes. I think those are very important.
Mm-hmm. That is great advice. I think it's, but it's so simple. I think people may be skeptical of just how powerful those two ideas are. Try it, folks, and let us know how it goes. So, Maria, looking back, what books have most inspired your working career? And please don't include any legal books.
I wasn't planning.
Oh, I had a feeling you wouldn't.
Yes. I think The 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene.
Oh, yeah.
It's a phenomenal book because it is a deep dive into the tactics and techniques of history's most famous and infamous characters, right? And how he presented that information was both enlightening and interesting. And obviously, there is cynicism and whatnot. But I think that if you read that book, you can't ever get tricked again, right? I mean, seriously, you can't get tricked again. And there is a lot of psychology and reading the other person's emotions and knowing people's motives. And I think that's a phenomenal book. And I think the second, or, you know, equally important, it was the biography of Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson, because Walter Isaacson was by Steve Jobs' side when he was writing the book. And to have that firsthand account from the man itself of how he built that company and what his ideas are and how he put them together is not only humbling, but also very, very inspiring. At no point in, it doesn't really matter the point that you're reading the book or where you are in your career, if it's like 10 years from today, I think there is full of nuggets of information, inspiration, excitement, aha moments. And it's always worth, I go back to it often because it's an important book for me.
Interesting, interesting. He is a very well-regarded and famous biographer. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading?
I really am interested in reading Brené Brown's latest book, Atlas of the Heart. I think that it's I love what she does with also data and feelings and emotions and how she's able to translate things that people don't want to talk about. For example, we were talking about empathy and authenticity mm-hmm. throughout this podcast.
And vulnerability,
Vulnerability. And she tells us why it's important to look at that. And the way that she presents information in her books is so clear. And it's almost like I feel that she's talking to all of us because all of us have been in some way or another in the situations that she outlines for us. And I think this is a more lighter, it's a lighter book. It has pictures and I don't know what. So I would love to read that book soon.
Oh, Atlas of the Heart. Great. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, your site, your LinkedIn profile, Twitter, all the books that you've mentioned and some of the interviews that I've mentioned. And to the listeners, I'd like to say, I want to ask you a big favor, okay? And I'm not going to ask you for a 5-star review, although if you do want to give me one, I will mail you a laptop sticker. And I'm not asking you to send me a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon, although if you want to send one, hey, you know, others have done it, or you could send one to Maria. But what I really want you to do is to reach out to Maria. Just reach out to her on LinkedIn or Twitter or on her website and just say, I heard you on the podcast. Thank you for putting up with that knucklehead stupid jokes. I really think your book sounds interesting. And if you have a question, contact her. But just yesterday, I heard from an author. She sent me an email and she says, I can't believe how many listeners from the Marketing Book Podcast have reached out to me. And I really, really enjoy it. It really makes the author's day. They've poured their hearts and souls into these books. And it's great when they hear from people. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or iTunes, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. Closing quote. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. I trust you are now convinced that creativity is not an elusive trait meant for a select few. Creativity is the strongest, most powerful and authentic amalgamation of qualities that any human can possess. So much so that no other species on our planet is equipped with creative thinking the way we are. Keep coming back to these pages when you need a boost of energy, feel short on motivation, or are looking to reinvigorate the alchemical faculties that allow you to turn your ideas into gold. The book is How Creativity Rules the World, The Art and Business of Turning Your Ideas into Gold. The author is Maria Brito. Maria, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas. It's been really a pleasure. Thank you for being so thorough and dedicated to what you do. And thank you to all the listeners for staying with us. I'm looking forward to hearing from all of you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."